Welcome to Brain Science, the show for everyone who has a brain. I'm your host, Dr. Ginger Campbell, and this is episode 140. This is our 11th annual review episode. If you are a new listener, this episode will give you a sense of what topics we covered in 2017. If you are a long-term listener, you know that I like to use the last episode of each year to look back on the year's highlights and to talk about my hopes for the future. This year, I'm going to include some highlights from last month's annual meeting of the Society of Neuroscience, which was held in Washington, D.C. As always, you will find complete show notes and episode transcripts at brainsciencepodcast.com, and you can send me email feedback at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com. I want to start out by thanking everyone who helps keep Brain Science going, not just financially, but also by sending me feedback and sharing the show with others. Creating this show is a lot of work, and your feedback has kept me going through the recent changes in my personal life. So let's get started. We started 2017 with episode 131, which was the second half of my look back at the first 10 years of Brain Science. One inevitable consequence of entering our 11th year is that some of the scientists I've interviewed have died. In 2017, we lost Dr. William Utal and Dr. Jacques Panksepp. In their memory, I replayed their past interviews. In episode 132, I featured Dr. William Utal's interview from 2012, in which we discussed his book, Mind and Brain, A Critical Appraisal of Neuroscience. This book is a very detailed look at the increasing use of functional magnetic imaging in the field of cognitive neuroscience. It's not a book for the average listener, but it is one I recommended at the time for those of you who work in the field. The book was published in 2012, so I'm sure he published at least one other book before he died. Mind and Brain is a critical look at fMRI in cognitive neuroscience. Utal seemed to have two main goals in writing this book. One was to explore the limits of fMRI, and the second was to challenge the assumption of localization. He concluded that brain imaging was the wrong level of analysis if we want to understand and explain how the brain makes the mind. He thought that the mind probably emerged at the level of interactions of individual neurons, and in an fMRI, the smallest unit is a voxel, which is like a 3D pixel, and this represents thousands of neurons. So he argued that the needed level of detail had been lost. There was also the problem of poor reproducibility, which causes divergent results in different studies. But there's a more fundamental problem. The fact that various studies seem to show activity in many different places suggests that asking where might be the wrong question. Instead of asking where a particular function resides in the brain, Dr. Utal proposed what he called a new metaphor in which the brain responds to almost any stimulus and every area of the brain participates in multiple functions. Of course, this will sound familiar to those of you who listened to the interview with Dr. Michael Anderson in episode 124, where he presented his neural reuse hypothesis. Of course, Dr. Utal's interview was from 2012, long before I had this conversation with Dr. Anderson about neural reuse. Dr. Utal also said several times during the interview that challenging localization is a minority viewpoint. Even in 2012, I thought that was changing. I include in the show notes for episode 132 links to other related episodes, especially those released since his interview was originally recorded. I continue to agree with Dr. Utal that we might be over-committing limited resources to brain imaging, but I don't think our prospects of understanding how the brain generates the mind are as bleak as he supposed. For example, Dr. Olaf Sporns, who has been on Brain Science several times, is exploring network theory as an alternative approach. Even though I only featured one of Dr. Utall's books. I think he was an important voice in reminding us that where is not the only question that we should ask, and it might not even be the best question. Back in 2012, I actually followed this episode up with one called Avoiding Neuromania, which is 109, talking about some of the other problems of overemphasizing fMRI. I don't know how many people are going to continue to read Dr. Utall's books, but I think he made an important contribution to the conversation, and possibly most significantly, he reminded us that we shouldn't take the interpretation of scientific results for granted. In episode 133, we talked with Dr. Susanna Herculano-Huzel, the author of The Human Advantage, How Our Brains Became Remarkable. I will mention that since this episode was originally released, this book has become available on Audible. I say this because this is a book that I encourage everyone to read, because she shares how science is really done and does it with the skill of a master storyteller. In this interview, we debunked several long-standing myths. One is the idea that we have a reptilian brain buried deep inside. Mammals are not descended from reptiles. We are more like cousins. Also, our cerebral cortex is less special than we thought, because it turns out that all vertebrates have a similar structure, although it might go by different names in birds and reptiles. Dr. Herculano-Huzel argues that the key difference is the number of neurons. A second myth is that our brains are too big for our bodies. It turns out that primate brains are different from those of other mammals, and that humans have exactly the size brain predicted for a primate of our size. Gorillas and orangutans actually have unusually small brains. It turns out that in most mammals, the brain doesn't grow as fast as the rest of the body. But in primates, the relationship is different. It's almost linear. This means that if you look at a rodent and a primate with the same body size, the primate is going to have a bigger brain. Now, there's a more important difference between primates and the generic mammal brain, and that is that in primates, the neurons do not get larger as the brain gets larger. This means that a primate can fit more neurons into the same brain size. This was actually totally unexpected and was really discovered after Herculano-Huzel developed what she calls her brain soup method for counting neurons. Before these experiments, it was assumed that all brains were built the same. Now we know they aren't. I wouldn't exactly call the idea that they were a myth, but it certainly was an assumption that has been proven wrong. This brings us to the blockbuster discovery, which is that the human brain contains, on average, 86 billion neurons, rather than the 100 billion that has long been assumed. And it also turns out there was no real source for this number of 100 billion. The lesson here is don't be afraid to read critically and ask, where did that fact come from? Meanwhile, they are also discovering that bird brains have many more neurons than expected. And then there's the strange case of the elephant. Its brain has 3 times as many neurons as the human brain, but most of these are in the cerebellum, not in the cortex. So let's review these surprises. First, not all brains are built the same. And second, not all neurons are the same size. I guess this means that in the future, experts will be able to tell from a microscope slide which animals' brains they are looking at from the size of its neurons. Another surprise is that the number of glial cells is relatively constant, probably because the way that they are added has not changed. And finally, there is the issue of folding. It turns out that cortical folding does not necessarily reflect the number of neurons, another long-held assumption. What is the human advantage? Dr. Herculano-Huzel argues that it is the fact that we have 16 billion neurons in our cortex, which is more than any other species. And this large number was probably made possible by the discovery of cooking, because this allows us to get enough energy to support all these neurons. As I said at the beginning, this book, The Human Advantage, is one that I highly recommend to all listeners. Episode 134 is a replay of Dr. Jacques Panksepp's second interview on brain science. I also interviewed him a third time on my other podcast, Books and Ideas. In that interview, we explored the implications of his work for our relationship with other animals. It was an honor to have interviewed him on three different occasions, and it was very gratifying to see his work get more recognition during the last few years of his life. Dr. Panksepp's main message was quite straightforward. Based on his decades of work with a wide variety of animals, he felt that he had isolated seven basic subcortical circuits that he called the origin of affective experience. His conclusion was that emotional experience originates in the subcortical parts of the brain that evolved before humans and even before primates. According to Dr. Panksepp, other animals may not be able to analyze their emotions the way we do, but there's no doubt that they have feelings. His evidence was quite straightforward. When you stimulate these circuits, the animals show predictable, reproducible behavior, and when they're given a choice, they will choose self-stimulation or avoidance, depending on whether they experience the stimulation as pleasant or unpleasant. When people have the same areas stimulated, they are usually able to describe emotions in the way that would be predicted from the animal experiments. The other half of the evidence is quite compelling. As most of you know, various motor and sensory experiences can be elicited by stimulating the cortex or the surface of the brain. This is often done prior to neurosurgery. However, you don't get pure affective or emotional experiences by stimulating the cortex. In fact, Dr. Panksepp mentioned an animal without a cortex still appears to have emotions, and Dr. Antonio Damasio has documented the case of a human without a cortex who appeared to have some affective reality. Then in episode 135, I interviewed Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett about her new book, How Emotions Are Made, The New Science of the Mind and Brain. She challenges some of Dr. Jacques Panksepp's conclusions, but I really wanted to focus on her book itself rather than any controversy. This is actually one of my favorite kinds of interviews because we not only talked about new ideas, but we got a feel for how science is really done by human beings. As I mentioned originally, this is an one-hour interview that can't really do justice to her book, which I encourage everyone to read, and is also available on Audible. How Emotions Are Made has three main sections. First, there is a discussion of why the classical theory of emotions needs to be abandoned. Second, the new theory of constructed emotions is discussed. And finally, the implications of this new theory, which include a discussion of why the classical theory is so difficult to abandon. In the first part, Dr. Barrett examines the evidence against the classical theory of emotions. There are many variations on the classical approach, but they all share the assumption that emotions are universal and hardwired. Many also include the idea that our emotions are generated by the so-called animal parts of the brain. The problem is that although this idea is appealing, it's not supported by the current evidence. Dr. Barrett reached this conclusion after searching for the universal fingerprints of emotion in three areas. First, she looked at facial expressions. Then she looked at the physiological or body measurements, and finally at the brain. We talked about all these in quite a bit of detail during the episode. But one thing we didn't talk about that you might have wondered about was Paul Ekman's work, which I did discuss back in episode 11. Ekman is famous for his research involving His research then involved showing pictures of faces to people from a wide variety of cultures. His work appeared to show that even primitive people could recognize universal emotions like happiness and surprise. This technique is called the basic emotion method and has been used widely in literally hundreds of studies. In her book, Dr. Barrett uncovers the methodological flaws in this method. First of all, the pictures are actually actors posing, not real people experiencing emotion. Second, the participants are asked to choose words that match the pictures. So here's the rub. If you take away the words, the results are completely different. People no longer describe the pictures consistently. In other words, priming the participants with Western emotion words produced the illusion of universality. There are lots of details and references about this in the book. One point she made in the book that bears repeating is that a successful theory has to account for all the evidence. And the reason a new theory was needed for emotions was that the evidence against the classical theory had become overwhelming. And as I say in the book, she talks also about the lack of universal physiological and brain fingerprints. So you really need to read the book if you need more evidence, which I would expect you would. Moving on to the theory of constructed emotions, the basic idea is straightforward. It says that our brain constructs our emotional experiences using the same circuits and functions that it uses to construct everything else we experience, including our perception of the world. Two things are at the heart of this process: prediction and concepts or categories. It's well established that perception is predictive, so much so that we can say that we see what we believe. We also hear, taste, and smell what we believe. Now we should add that we feel what we believe or expect. We learn to see objects in the world, and we also learn to feel emotions. We touched briefly on the role of words, but one thing we didn't talk about that's really important is that as humans, what we learn is highly social. We learn about emotions from our culture. Dr. Barrett discusses this in more detail in How Emotions Are Made, including giving several examples of emotions that are unique to other cultures. We did talk a little bit about development and how children rapidly learn to see similarities and differences with the help of words. This principle applies to everything we learn, including emotions. This means that we did not inherit universal emotions from our non-human ancestors. What we did inherit was the ability to form concepts and categories. Even before they learn to talk, children assume that if two things have the same name, then they must have something in common. So they are exposed to the emotion words used in their culture, and they begin to associate these words with both how they feel and how others around them act. This has important implications. One final topic that came up during our conversation was the concept of affective realism, which is a subset of naive realism. Naive realism is the belief that our senses provide an accurate and objective representation of the world. The more we learn about how our brains work, the more untenable this belief becomes. But that doesn't mean we should embrace idealism, which claims that the world exists only in our minds. No, it just means that things are not exactly as they seem. Instead, our brain gives us a version of the world, including our bodies, that hopefully allows us to survive and flourish. Affective realism is making decisions based on our gut feelings. We can't help but be affective realists because we often have to make decisions before we have all the sensory data. But it's important that we be aware of this tendency. For example, shooting an unarmed person when you see a gun that is not there is a sobering example of believing is seeing. While there are situations where we have no choice but to act on our gut feelings, it's very important to realize that bad feelings do not always mean that something is wrong. Let's say you meet someone and you automatically dislike them. Affective realism is assuming that there must be a valid reason for this reaction. But I'm sure we've all had the experience where we met someone we didn't like initially and later we became very close friends. That's a pretty benign example, But if you're in a position of power, like the judges who deny parole when they're hungry, then engaging in affective realism can harm others. This is an example of how our theories about emotions can have real-world implications. Before I talk about that in a little bit more detail, I want to discuss one other topic that Dr. Barrett did not touch on during our conversation. We talked a little bit about the social or learned aspects of emotions. We did not talk about where the feelings that we name actually begin. After all, emotions aren't just the thoughts in our heads. They are associated with signals from our body. The signals inside our body are called interoception. If you want to learn more about interoception, I recommend going back to Bud Craig's interview, which is episode 121. The purpose of interoception is to help the body regulate its energy and keep us alive. Let's return to the example of the small baby. Although emotions aren't hardwired, interoception and affect are. And affect is really what Dr. Panksepp studied. Affect consists of valence and arousal. Valence is this experience pleasant or unpleasant? And then arousal is exactly what it sounds like. Are you aroused or calm? It's easy to see that babies and other animals experience affect. Dr. Barrett agrees with Dr. Panksepp that affect is probably a fundamental aspect of consciousness. In the theory of constructed emotion, the brain combines interoception and affect to create an instance of emotion. Now, here's the thing that might be hard to accept. We intuitively feel that what we see and hear influences how we feel, but it's mostly the other way around. How you feel alters what you see and hear. You also feel what your brain believes. The key idea is that what you feel is based on predictions from your knowledge of the past experience. Believing is feeling. Summing it up, the failure to find the fingerprints of emotions prompted Dr. Barrett to search for a theory that was a better fit to our current neuroscience. This is what led to the theory of constructed emotions, which basically says that instances of emotion are generated by the brain by mechanisms that are very similar to the way it generates sensory perceptions, which is via prediction. In the case of emotion, the prediction is based on affect, interoception, context, and past experience. So it's a whole brain phenomenon. Dr. Barrett emphasized that this is a theory in the scientific sense of the word because it is supported by a great deal of evidence and it makes testable predictions. In the last third of how predictions are made, she focuses on the implications of the theory, and one reason why I invited her on the show was that the theory of constructed emotions has the potential to change the way we see ourselves. First, we aren't passive receivers of experience. We are active participants in determining what we see, even though this happens outside of our awareness. Emotions are constructed in the same manner, which means we construct our emotional experience and our perception of other people's emotions. Barrett goes into a lot more detail about this in the book, but the point is that the theory of constructed emotions empowers us to find ways to change when we need to. The principle of brain plasticity applies here also. The world around you wires your brain. Do you surround yourself with anger and hate, or do you surround yourself with people who nurture positive emotions? Obviously, abandoning the classical view of emotions has great implications for our justice system, since it is very much entrenched in classical theory. Dr. Barrett devotes chapters to this in her book and also talks about how it could impact our attitudes about health. But overall, abandoning the classic view is quite empowering. We no longer have to see ourselves as victims of an internal struggle between our emotions and reason. Of course, if you're a longtime listener, you know that the idea that emotions and reason are separate is totally obsolete because emotion and cognition or decision-making are deeply entwined at all levels of the brain. The ideas expressed in How Emotions Are Made actually fit quite easily with the ideas of many of the guests we've had over the last few years. But as I expected, many of you have expressed resistance to giving up the classical view. It has driven emotion research for many decades. Dr. Barrett actually addresses this problem in How Emotions Are Made. Ironically, the problem is that we seem to be hardwired to be realists, which means that affective realism feels right. And it means that we tend to judge theories on whether or not they feel right. This episode generated strong reaction from listeners, which is why I encourage everyone to actually read the book, because Dr. Barrett has constructed a very solid argument, and you can also follow up the references if you are so inclined. The fact that neuroscience has reached a point where its theories no longer match our intuition just means that the field is maturing along the lines of other scientific disciplines. As Dr. Robert Burton reminded us back in episode 96, we are limited by the fact that our brains not only create the world we experience, but they tell us what to believe. It's generally hard to question one's own gut feelings or intuitions, but if you believe in following the evidence, then this is both a challenge and an opportunity. In episode 137, we discuss the book Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It by Dr. Mark Seidenberg. This is really sort of a return to our roots because early on the Brain Science podcast, we focused on book discussions, and then there was a gradual shift toward interviewing authors whenever possible. I still get emails from listeners who like the old style, so this one is for you. The most important thing in Language at the Speed of Sight is that although reading science continues to evolve in the way all true science does, it has converged on several important principles that are currently not being used to help children learn to read. The evidence that phonological processing is important comes not just from behavior research, but also from imaging studies and brain stimulation methods. In addition, new methods of computational modeling are inspiring new ideas in research. I touched briefly on how the speed of reading is tied to physiological limits, both in visual processing and cognitive processing. This means that speed reading, at least for comprehension, is a myth. I also enjoyed thinking about writing as our first information technology. It's a pretty incredible invention. The question of how humans originally made the leap from spoken language to representing language in written form may never be answered, but we are increasing our understanding of how written languages have been influenced by underlying human cognitive processes. And it's even more intriguing to explore how reading changes both our brain and our relationship to language. It's sobering to realize that a universal system for writing is unlikely given the wide diversity of human language. It's time to stop thinking that the alphabet is the only way to go. I highly recommend Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What We Can Do About It by Dr. Mark Seidenberg, especially if you're interested in the science of reading or if you're interested in how reading is taught. If you go to the original show notes for this episode, you will find additional references. In 2018, I hope to have Marianne Wolfe back on the show. I interviewed her back in 2007 about her book, Proust and the Squid, which is about the reading brain. In 2016, she published a new book called Tales of Literacy. I'm hoping that she's going to give us an update on what she's learned over the last 10 years. The reality of a life in science is that you must constantly adapt to new evidence. Sometimes this means giving up cherished ideas, such as when we consider the possibility that not all of Jacques Panksepp's ideas will stand the test of time. Episode 138 was Dr. Seth Grant's third appearance on Brain Science, but it's the first time that he's come on to share brand new research. As many of you know, I usually focus on books rather than the current literature, But back in 2008, I was introduced to Dr. Grant's work by a loyal listener, and I discovered that he's always uncovering something new and fascinating, and he's great at explaining his work. That's why I keep having him on the show. But if you listen to this episode at the very when it's first released, or shortly even now, then you get to hear about a new discovery that could have profound implications. First, a few basics. Humans have about 20,000 genes. It's estimated that about 85% of these are expressed or turned on in the brain. The way scientists determine which genes are expressed in a given tissue is by looking for the corresponding messenger RNA, because proteins are actually synthesized via messenger RNA. So there are three important terms. There's the genome, which is the list of all the genes, which is on the DNA. Then there's the transcriptome, which is a list of all the messenger RNA present in a particular tissue. And then there's the proteome, which is the list of all the proteins. The paper that we talked about was actually pretty technical, but as Dr. Grant explained, the key idea is straightforward. Brains of both mice and humans appear to develop according to a genetic calendar that is so precise that it's actually possible to predict the brain's age by looking at the transcriptome, that is, what messenger RNA is present. The first implication of this study is that it could explain why certain illnesses and diseases like schizophrenia usually appear around the same age. Preliminary work implicates some of the complex postsynaptic proteins that have already been shown to affect learning and brain plasticity. It's important to emphasize that prior to this particular work, we didn't know that this genetic calendar existed. This obviously has some exciting implications, but I think eventually it could have a profound impact on how we study brain development and aging. At the very least, it implies that the age of the brain matters at a very fundamental level. So for episode 138, I wanted to get to something a little less technical, so I invited John Medina to come back on to talk about his latest book, Brain Rules for Aging Well. It's always fun to talk with Dr. Medina because his enthusiasm is so contagious. His new book is, as always, written in a very down-to-earth style, but full of useful information. And I should point out that even though it's aimed at older adults, the principles are valid no matter what your age. A key idea that stood out for me is that the brain is wired to be social. Engaging with others face-to-face is cognitively demanding, and it helps keep your executive functions at their best. Conversely, loneliness is bad, not only for your overall health, but also for your brain. This means that we need to resist the temptation to stay home and look for opportunities to engage with the world and with other people. Dr. Medina also told us that practicing gratitude helps increase the dopamine level in our brain, and the evidence is mounting that mindfulness meditation actually improves cognition. In the book, he talked about ways that our memory changes as we age, but we focused on things that we could do that help. Besides learning something new, which I've talked about often in the past, he emphasized the benefits of teaching others. That's something I never really thought about, but it's definitely true that teaching others is both challenging and invigorating. Is there a skill or special knowledge that you could share with others? Medina also mentioned that if you read an actual book more than 3.5 hours a day, that's good cognitively. There is an excellent chapter in the book about Alzheimer's disease that includes an overview of the current research as well as 10 signs to look for. We didn't get into it, but it's a great chapter. We did talk about diet and exercise, and there were two things on the exercise front that surprised me. One was the particular power of dancing, and the other was how little it takes to make a difference. Anything that you can do to keep moving is a good idea. Final thought that I emphasized in this episode and will emphasize again today is the importance of a positive attitude toward aging. Brain Rules for Aging Well is an easy, fun read, but it's chock full of useful science about the brain. Finally, in episode 139, I interviewed Dr. Jeff Hawkins, author of On Intelligence and founder of Numenta. Just to remind you, Dr. Hawkins' book On Intelligence was reviewed in episode 2, which was originally recorded for another podcast. I talked with Dr. Hawkins in episode 38, which unfortunately I think has the worst audio of any episode ever that I've ever recorded. In fact, it inspired the beginning of getting transcripts made for every episode. So I guess that was a good thing. So it was great to talk to Jeff Hawkins again. And I hope when you listen to this interview, you will get a sense of his passion for neuroscience. I want to mention that all the papers that we talked about in this interview are available at the Numenta website, and I did link to them in the original show notes. The main reason that I continue to follow the work that Hawkins is doing at Numenta is that his team is actually trying to build a model of cortical function that matches the brain's anatomy and physiology, which of course means generating testable hypotheses. It's interesting that one of the email responses I got to this interview was a writer who claimed that this was an impossible goal. At any rate, in 2016, Hawkins' team published a new model that incorporates the fact that not all synapses are identical. In particular, their function seems to depend on where they are located on the dendrites. Only synapses near the cell body can cause an action potential. In this new model, Hawkins proposes that other synapses prepare the cell to fire, which in a sense is a form of prediction. The other paper that they published in 2016 showed how sparseness leads to robustness. As Hawkins explained, having a sparse representation reduces overlap, which means that the signal is robust even in the noisy environment of real neurons. Then in 2017, they expanded their model to represent a very simple column. This is a key step toward making the model realistic because we know that the real cortex has a columnar structure, but exactly how columns work is not yet known. Hawkins proposes that the key information that is needed for a column to identify an object is positional, but that the positional information is allocentric, which means it's based on the object itself, not on the person or the animal doing the sensing. For example, if you are touching a coffee cup, the location on the handle relative to the cup helps you recognize what it is. The other key idea is that although a single column can theoretically recognize hundreds of objects, having additional columns allows recognition to occur more rapidly, just like you can recognize a coffee cup more quickly if you use several fingers at once instead of just one finger. There is a video that demonstrates these ideas that I linked to in the original show notes. This interview and the one with Seth Grant represent a departure from my usual focus on books, but I have to point out that although it's exciting to have neuroscientists share their work hot off the presses, so to speak, their ideas will need to be tested and they may be possibly disproven by other scientists. Both Grant and Hawkins recognize this, but I don't think it would be realistic for me to try to shift to covering the leading edge of neuroscience on a regular basis. The first goal of brain science is to give non-scientists an accurate and accessible account of neuroscience. This means staying fairly mainstream, because one of the things that we know about how our brains work is that once we think a certain thing is true, that's what we remember, even if we later read or hear evidence that overturns that previous understanding. Even scientists who are committed to following the evidence have a hard time changing their minds. I think the reaction to Lisa Barrett's interview illustrates this principle. She provided solid evidence that we need to abandon our classical view of emotions, but most of us are finding this very hard to do. In 2018, I hope to release a show on the fourth Monday of each month, and my goal is to release 12 completely new episodes. In 2017, Brain Science was mostly commercial-free, although the Great Courses Plus did sponsor 3 episodes at the end of the year. In fact, you can still get a free month of access to their content by going to thegreatcourses.com/ginger. Unfortunately, they've been disappointed with the response so far, so it's doubtful that they will continue to support the show. In 2018, I'm going to see if I can find some NPR-type underwriting, but your support continues to be my main source of income. To be very blunt, I need the combination of premium subscribers, donations, and Patreon supporters. I know that some of you assume that I am a rich doctor, but this has never been true. In fact, when I left the emergency room in 2014 to train in palliative medicine, I took a big pay cut. And although my income has recovered since I went back to work at the VA, I still make much less than I did as an emergency physician. That combined with my husband's death in 2015 has put me in a situation where I can't afford to do this work for free. The easiest way to support the show is via the premium subscription, which is only $5 a month. Lipson manages the premium content, and I get half that fee. I have intentionally kept the price low so that most listeners can afford it, and the most 50 recent episodes always remain free. If you want to learn more about how you can support the show, please go to brainsciencepodcast.com/donations. Now, I want to spend a few minutes talking about Neuroscience 2017. I last attended the annual meeting of the Society for Neuroscience back in 2008, when the show was barely 2 years old. Probably the biggest change is that now many working neuroscientists and students actually listen to the show, though it's hard to find anyone you know at a meeting of 30,000 people. Also, I was disappointed that I wasn't able to get into the luncheon celebrating women in neuroscience, because that was one of my highlights of 2008. I am going to talk about a couple of the talks that stand out for me. The main one was a roundtable on hearing loss and dementia. Hearing loss is incredibly common as people get older, and it turns out that it's more than just a nuisance. It has a negative impact on mood, cognitive function, and even physical function. Most importantly, there is now overwhelming evidence that hearing loss increases the risk of developing dementia. This may be because when a person has problems with hearing, they have to devote more cognitive resources to hearing, leaving less reserved for other activities. Just think about how hard it is to carry on a conversation in a loud room when you have normal hearing, and it leaves you exhausted. Another obvious problem is social isolation. When people can't hear, they tend to withdraw from social interactions. And as John Medina explained in episode 138, social interaction provides an important protective effect to cognitive function. Interdisciplinary teams are now studying what actually happens in the brain when people can't hear. And the good news is that correcting hearing loss can reverse these changes. There are, of course, many challenges. Not all types of hearing loss can be helped with traditional hearing aids, and most people are very reluctant to wear them. One exciting development is a recently passed law in the United States which will allow hearing aids to be sold over the counter. This law will take effect in 3 years, and researchers are excited that this will make a big difference because it will encourage tech giants like Apple and Samsung to enter the market. Imagine if your Bluetooth earpiece could be attached to a hearing aid app. No one would even know you were wearing a hearing aid. The realization that hearing loss is a significant preventable cause of dementia is a big deal. In 2017, The Lancet published the Lancet Commission on Dementia Prevention, in which they estimated about a 9% reduction in risk if this could be treated. That's about twice the amount related to smoking. Needless to say, this ought to spur massive research efforts. I'll try to put some reference for this in for you in the show notes. But the key idea here is that I chose this topic today because I think it's essential that this information reach the general public. Do you or someone you love have trouble hearing? Please don't ignore it. Another session I attended was about the use of storytelling in communicating neuroscience. This is not a new idea to me, although I don't think I'm very good at this particular aspect of science communication. But the fact that there was a session devoted to this shows that neuroscientists, like scientists in general, are becoming more aware of the importance of sharing their work with the public. As I mentioned last month, I also attended a talk by Demi Hassabis, the founder of the DeepMind Project, which is now part of Google. Unfortunately, when I look back at my notes, I found them to be a little sketchy, and because I really wanted to release this episode before Christmas, I've decided to move the discussion of his work to a future episode. In fact, I have sent him an invitation to come on Brain Science, which I hope he will accept. As I look back on 2017, my biggest disappointment is the fact that I did not create as much new content as you deserve, especially if I'm asking you to support the show financially. I did move to a new home, which felt like an important step in recovering from my husband's unexpected death in 2015. And as I've already mentioned, my goal for 2018 is to produce a new episode every month. For the sake of new listeners, I'm going to close by reviewing some of the other resources that are available on the Brain Science Podcast website. Long-term listeners may also find this useful. If you visit brainsciencepodcast.com, you can find links to just about anything you could need. Some of these are obvious, like a link to the Facebook fan page or newsletter sign up, or link to the discussion forum on Goodreads. But one thing you may not have noticed is that at the very top of every page, there are links, and the one in the top right-hand corner is called Resources. If you hover over this, you'll see links to most of the things I usually talk about. But in particular, I want to remind you that there is a bibliography page. This includes every book ever featured on the show. Lori Wolfson graciously helps me keep this up to date. But if you see something missing, please drop me an email at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com. If you find a bad link or anything else that is outdated, please let me know. One other thing I want to remind you about is that there is a search bar at the top of the right sidebar that appears on most pages. This is the easiest way to find a guest or a topic that you are looking for. There are separate pages listing all the episodes and guests, but after 11 years, these lists have gotten a little cumbersome. It's amazing to realize that I've been hosting this show since December 2006. If there's anyone out there who's been listening from the beginning, I would love to hear from you. And of course, I want to hear from you even if you just started listening. You can write to me at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com. When I started this show in 2006, I figured I would never run out of material, and that has certainly proven to be true. I want to close by extending a special thanks to everyone who has supported my work financially over the last 10 years. But as always, I want to remind you that the most important thing you can do doesn't cost anything. Please help Brain Science grow by sharing it with others in whatever way works best for you. Thanks again for listening. I look forward to talking with you in 2018. Brain Science is copyright 2017 to Virginia Campbell, MD. You may copy this to share it with others, but for any other uses or derivatives, please contact me at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com.